So, you know, this is, it's a great pleasure to be here, in particular as part of the Regional Data Forum. You know, as an economist, as Sam mentioned, a child of two statisticians, I'm pretty much almost by definition a data geek. And so it's especially heartwarming to be here. And I want to especially thank, as I mentioned, I want to thank those of you who took time for your busy schedules to meet with my members of my staff and myself this morning to discuss the Black Hills area economy and its challenges and opportunities. It is especially important for monetary policymakers to have a deep understanding of how the economy works. And one of the ways that we attain that understanding is through opportunities like this. The comments and questions that you all share, whether in meetings or lunch, or in the question and answer session that's going to follow this talk, will all help to shape my thinking about the economy and about policy. So I became president of the Minneapolis Fed in October of 2009, and one of my main objectives since then has been to make both the Minneapolis Fed and the Federal Reserve System more open and more transparent. And I've been delighted to learn that I'm not at all alone in this pursuit of greater openness. I see many positive developments along these lines throughout the system, especially on the part of the Federal Open Market Committee. The FOMC, as I mentioned, is the monetary policy-making arm of the Federal Reserve. It meets every 6 to 7 weeks, to chart the course of monetary policy. The members of the Board of Governors in Washington and the presidents of the 12 regional Feds, including me, all take part in this meeting. So today I will talk about a significant improvement in the FOMC's communication about monetary policy. In January of 2012, the FOMC released a consensus statement describing its long-run framework. Congress has given the Federal Reserve a dual mandate to promote maximum employment and to promote price stability. The January framework statement is important because it outlines the strategy the FOMC follows in order to implement the dual mandate of price stability and maximum employment. As you will hear, the framework statement provides a quantitative definition for price stability through a numerical target for inflation. It does not do the same for maximum employment. And I will spend a considerable amount of time discussing this latter aspect of the statement and its relevance for current policy. This picture will be an important part of that. Before proceeding, I'll remind you my remarks today reflect my own thoughts and not necessarily those of others in the Federal Reserve System. Let me begin with some historical context. Over the past 30 years, central banks all over the world have become much more transparent about their objectives and how their current actions allow them to achieve those objectives. This transparency is widely viewed by both policymakers and scholars is an important means of enhancing the effectiveness of monetary policy. Now, most central banks aim to keep medium-term inflation low and stable at around 2% annually. And they have been quite successful in that goal for the past 20 or 25 years. They view that success as being due in part to their communicating on an ongoing basis about how their current policy actions are consistent with that goal of 2% inflation. So there are at least two benefits of transparency. The first is broadly appreciated. By being clear about their objectives, central banks are better able to achieve those objectives. For example, the central bank announces its inflation target is 2% per year. Firms and employees know that wages need to grow by 2% to keep up with the cost of living. And that knowledge helps keep wages from growing so fast that firms have to raise prices by more than 2% to cover their labor costs. And that, in turn, contributes to keeping inflation under control. So in brief, then, transparency is a way to anchor people's inflationary expectations. Now, the second benefit of transparency is less appreciated, but I think it's no less important. A transparent central bank is more accountable to the public. It is because it is forced to be more disciplined, ensuring that its policy actions are in fact consistent with its policy objectives. The central bank knows the public will be able to track its performance. And performance matches words, Powell will have an even stronger belief in the central bank, which serves to anchor inflation expectations even more solidly. So there's been a trend towards central bank transparency internationally. What about here in the United States? I think we can all take pride in the fact that under Chairman Bernanke and under his predecessor, Chairman Greenspan, the Fed has made enormous strides in transparency. It is easy to forget that as recently as 1993, so less than 20 years ago, the Fed would act and not tell anyone what it had done for 90 days. It was not until 2000 that the FOMC began issuing the statement that many of us now take for granted. And it was a decade ago that the roll call vote of FOMC members was added to the statement. So there's been substantial progress in monetary policy transparency over the past 15 or so years, going from a point where the FOMC would not tell anyone for 90 days to the current situation where there's a release of a statement and a vote. So with that in mind, at the beginning of 2011, so beginning of last year, the committee had arrived at three main forms of communication about policy. So after every one of these eight meetings, immediately after, the committee issues a carefully worded but brief statement intended to describe the current state of the economy and the current stance of monetary policy. Second, 3 weeks after each meeting, the committee issues a carefully worded set of minutes that provides a longer, but still relatively high level, description of interactions within the meeting. Third, after the January, April, June, and October, November meetings, depending which month that takes place, the FOMC releases a summary of economic projections. Now, these projections are the projections that are provided by all of the meeting participants. And among other things, these quarterly releases will contain information about the meeting participants' goals for medium run inflation and unemployment. Over the next 5 to 6 years. Okay, so that's where we stood at the beginning of 2011. There have been several changes in FOMC communications over the past year, including the introduction of regular press conferences by the chairman and the regular release of FOMC's participants' individual assessments of the appropriate path of short-term interest rates. But I'm going to spend my time today, and both of these are significant, but I want to spend my time today discussing the changes I've used in Paul's report. The FOMC's release in January of 2012 of a five-paragraph statement describing its long-run framework. Now, this statement is not important because it does not signify any change in the committee's approach to policy, to making policy. But I think it's an important step forward in the committee's communication of that approach to the public. In particular, I think this statement is providing the basic principles of how the committee goes about implementing the statutory dual mandate that I mentioned earlier, that monetary policy should promote price stability and maximum employment. Now, I'm not going to go through this statement in any detail. Frankly, I don't think there's any need for me to do so. It's short, it's, I think, remarkably well worded, and it, part of that is it deliberately shies away from technical language. I encourage all of you, indeed all Americans, to read it when you have the opportunity. It's located on the Board of Governors website. What I'm going to do instead is to focus on four aspects of this framework statement that was released in January. Before August, that I view is especially important. Okay, so first key aspect of the framework is it provides a specific translation of the term price stability. And it translates it into a 2% target for inflation. The American public need guess no longer about the Federal Reserve's inflation intentions, either on the upside, which often gets more of the attention, but or on the downside either. The Federal Reserve is aiming to keep inflation at 2%. Second, the framework describes how the committee weighs the two mandates, promoting maximum employment, promoting price stability, against one another. And the I think what the key here is that it stresses that the two mandates are actually typically complementary to one another. In the sense that keeping unemployment from rising too high also keeps inflation from falling too low. And I think this point of the complementarity of our two mandates is often underemphasized in popular discussions of monetary policy. Third, the framework statement enjoyed broad consensus support among meeting participants. And I think this suggests that any changes in the framework statement will require that same level of broad consensus support. In this sense, I think one can think of the framework as really being like a constitution. It can change, but it will take a broad consensus of support among meeting participants to implement that change. So I move very quickly through these first three of these key elements of the framework statement. Inflation target of 2%, typical complementarity of the two mandates, and the quasi-constitutionality of the statement. The fourth key feature of the statement is that while it provides a numerical target for inflation, it does not provide a similar explicit quantitative interpretation of the second mandate, maximum employment. And I want to spend the rest of my time discussing why it does not do so. So I'll start with a quote from the framework statement itself. The maximum level of employment is largely determined by non-monetary factors that affect the structure and the dynamics of the job market. What are these non-monetary factors to which the statement refers? There are many of them. Population trends, the incentives built into the tax system, incentives built into the social insurance safety nets, the returns of human capital accumulation by young people, and simply social norms. The FOMC has no control over these non-monetary factors. Its job is to attain the maximum of employment attainable through monetary policy, taking these other non-monetary factors that I mentioned as given. Now, it's important to note this long list of non-monetary factors includes non-monetary policies. It follows that even if employment is close to the maximum level that's achievable through monetary policy, there may well be non-monetary policy levers that could be used to raise employment still higher. For example, suppose that Congress and the President chose to reduce the payroll tax paid by employers. Such a move would provide an additional incentive to employers to hire more workers, albeit at the cost of increasing the deficit. But providing this incentive to employers would increase employment and reduce unemployment. Now, all of these non-monetary factors, policy or otherwise, fluctuate over time. Their changes, in turn, generate fluctuations in the level of maximum employment that's achievable through monetary policy. And these fluctuations are often hard to gauge on a real-time basis. And I'm going to spend some time today describing why I believe that the committee faces an especially large amount of uncertainty about the level of maximum employment that it can hope to achieve. So I'm going to start by showing you four graphs. Graphs are four measures of the recent adverse changes in U.S. labor market performance. Now, to understand the graphs, it's helpful to recall that economists define the labor force to include two groups. It's all those people over 16 years of age that either have a job or have looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. That's what the labor force is. And then all the charts are going to depict annual data through the year 2011. Okay, so here's the first graph. And it depicts the evolution of the unemployment rate over time. And that's the fraction of people in the labor force who have looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. And the graph shows that after rising sharply from 2007 to 2009, and the shaded area here is depicting the recession that began in December of 2007 and the state is having ended in June of 2009. But after rising sharply from 2007 to 2009, the unemployment rate has been falling slowly. So that's the first graph, the unemployment rate. The next graph is what's called the employment population ratio. This is the fraction of people in the of people over the age of 60. The fraction of people in these ages who have a job. So what we've done is focus on people aged 25 to 54, just to strip out some of the demographic effects that sometimes people worry about conflating these measures. So these are so-called prime age workers. Now we can see a sharp decline in this ratio from 2007 to 2009. And in contrast to the unemployment rate, there has been no noticeable recovery in this measure. Okay, so the fraction of people aged 25 to 54 fell sharply beginning in 2007, and you really don't see you can't see that starting to come back up. So that's the second picture. Now the third graph is the depiction of the fraction of population in the age of 25 to 54 who are in the labor force. So these are people in this age 25 to 54 who either have a job or have looked for a job in the past 4 weeks. Now, I think an interesting aspect of this graph is you really start to see it start to come down pretty early on, in 2000 itself. So it comes down, it rises back up, and it's fairly flat. And then it really accelerates, beginning in 2008, there's a downward trend that accelerates in 2008. Okay, so these are three of the four pictures I want to show you. The last one is the most complicated. What is this graph? This is a depiction of the relationship of unfilled job openings and unemployment over time. The horizontal axis of this graph is the unemployment rate, and the vertical axis is what's called the job openings or vacancy rate. Each point of the graph corresponds to a different year. So for the year 2001, for example, you take the unemployment rate for that year, take the vacancy rate for that year, and put a point in the graph. 2002, you put another point in the graph corresponding to the unemployment rate for that year, the vacancy rate. Now, when the economy is doing well, firms usually hire more workers, and they find it more challenging to fill their available openings. So the unemployment rate tends to be low, and the vacancy rate tends to be high. So as the economy improves, we should be moving in the towards the upper left of the picture, to the northwest. Conversely, as the times get worse, we should move to the southeast. This creates a curve that runs from the northwest to the southeast. And that curve is known as the Beveridge curve. After an economist. Now, in the Great Recession and its aftermath, so I don't know if I can use a point here. This point here is 2009, 2010, 2011. What have we seen here? The Beveridge curve is not just running up and down like this, it's actually shifted outward. Now this represents a decline in the ability of the labor market to form mutually beneficial matches between workers and firms. This outward shift means that firms can't fill their available job openings as readily as you would expect, given how high the unemployment rate is. There's more job openings out here in 2011 than we would have expected, given an unemployment rate of well over 8%. So that's four pictures about the U.S. Labor market outcomes remain notably worse than prior to the recession. The unemployment rate has been starting to come down, but labor force participation has been falling steadily. The employee population ratio remains near its low point, and the Beveridge curve shows considerable deterioration in labor market matching conditions. Big question, how persistent will these changes in the U.S. labor market . Economists, as is their wont, hold at least two views on this question. Well, it depends on how many economists you ask on it. So the first view is guided by patterns in post-World War II data for the United States. And these patterns, I'm not going to show you them, these patterns would suggest that the current deterioration in U.S. labor market performance is indeed reversible under appropriate policy. We've seen these kind of changes during recessions, and then the recoveries are reversed in some. The second view is less sanguine. It says the post-World War II data do not contain an economic crisis of the kind or magnitude that hit the United States in 2008. And such a crisis could well have a different kind of impact on labor markets than the earlier post-war recessions. Now, this latter view is also informed by data, but it's informed by data from the countries, not from the United States. So my staff and I have recently been taking a close look at data from Sweden. Now, why Sweden? In the early 1990s, Sweden was hit by a financial, banking, and currency crisis all at the same time. What one might call a triple crisis. Of course, other industrialized countries, most notably Japan, have experienced these kinds of crises. Why we focused on Sweden, is because it's generally viewed as having dealt with the triple crisis in a highly effective fashion. It's generally viewed as a success story. So in 2007, OECD economists write, Sweden's economy has made a remarkable recovery from the major crisis of the early 1990s. You can find similar quotes from a wide variety of sources. But despite this success, this bond of success, the triple crisis has had a profound and highly persistent effect on the Swedish labor market. So I'm going to show you the same graphs that I showed you for the US, I'm going to show you for Sweden. Let's see the Swedish unemployment rate. So the shaded gray area here for Sweden is the time of the triple crisis I referred to was at its peak from the years 1991 to 1993. So the Swedish unemployment rate from 1980 to 1990 had never been above 4%. It was typically closer to 2%. After 1993, the unemployment rate was never much below 6. So that's the unemployment rate. This is the Swedish employment population ratio, again, focusing on those age groups I mentioned earlier, 25 to 54. From 1980 to 1990, the employment population ratio grew steadily in Sweden and peaked at over 91%. Now, I actually think this is amazing. The fall that took place in this number over something like a 2 to 3 year period. The way to think about it, to realize how amazing it is to think about sort of one minus it, the fraction of people who don't have a job in Sweden who are aged 25 to 54. In 1990, only about 9% of the Swedish population aged 25 to 54 did not have a job. In the space of 3 years, that doubled to 18%. That's a pretty big change in your labor market. What I want to emphasize though more is what happened after that, after the gray shaded area, after the triple crisis, the ratio definitely trended upwards slightly, but it's remained below 86% for most of this period. So you definitely see a decline and a persistent decline in the employment population. I'm going to show you labor force participation now. And it's sort of the same story. From 1980 to 1990, this fraction rose to a high of over 92%. After 1993, it was typically around 88% and never much above 90%. And finally, we can look at the beverage curve. So this is the same plot of unemployment rates versus vacancies for Sweden that I showed you for the US, although starting in 1980. So it's essentially, you see that you're running up and down one curve here from 1980 to 1990 or 91. Then there's the big the triple crisis. Here's 1992, here's 1993. You move back up, and now since then, they've moved along this curve instead. So there's been that deterioration, the labor market matching efficiency I described for the United States, it took place in Sweden and it stayed with them for the next 17 years. Okay, so to sum up, these four measures of Swedish labor market performance declined markedly after the triple crisis of the early 90s. And at least up until now, this decline has proved to be a permanent. I should note, too, that these changes took place over a relatively short period of time. I would say a remarkably short period of time. In its February 1995 inflation report, the Riksbank, the Swedish central bank, suggests that the rate of unemployment they viewed as sustainable over the long run had risen from 2 to 3% back in the pre-1990 to 6% in less than 5 years. Their assessment, which was made again back in 1995, has proven to be a remarkably accurate characterization of the Swedish labor market over the next 15 years. Now, it is important to emphasize, of course, there are many institutional differences between Sweden and the United States, especially in terms of tax systems and social safety nets. It would be a mistake to conclude from the Swedish data alone that the recent decline in U.S. labor market measures is inevitably a permanent one. Sweden is not atypical. Cross-country research from Reinhardt and Weinhardt, among others, has found that financial crises can be followed by sustained increases in unemployment. So I do think the Swedish data, especially given they come from a country generally regarded as an exemplar of how to handle a financial crisis, have to be viewed as informative. At a minimum, Sweden's experience forces us to contemplate the possibility that erosion of labor market performance that we've seen in the United States over the past 5 years can be highly persistent, even under appropriate monetary policy. So, over the past 10 minutes or so, I've talked about the recent adverse changes in U.S. labor market performance, and I've talked about two sharply different ways to view those changes. One, they're largely reversible under appropriate monetary policy, and the second, they're likely to be highly persistent even under appropriate policy. These two possibilities suggest that the FOMC is confronted with an unusually high degree of uncertainty about the level of maximum employment that it can achieve. And this uncertainty translates directly into a corresponding uncertainty about the appropriate approach to policy. So policymakers who see deterioration in labor market performance as reversible using monetary policy typically give more accommodative policy than those who view the deterioration as more protracted. Now, we can unfortunately use other sources of information to reduce the level of uncertainty about maximum level of employment achievable through monetary policy. The maximum employment for monetary policy is widely viewed as a level of employment that is sustainable through monetary policy actions without an acceleration in inflation. So even though we can't directly observe maximum employment, we do observe inflation. So its behavior can then be a useful signal of how close we are to the maximum level of employment achievable by the FOMC. So what's been happening? Inflation was distinctly higher in 2011 than in 2010, and it continues to run above the FOMC's target of 2%. Even core measures of inflation, which strip out energy goods and services and food, went up notably from 2010 to 2011. Now, I see these changes in inflation as a signal that our country's current labor market performance is much closer to maximum employment, given the tools available to the FOMC, than the post-World War II U.S. data alone would suggest. And as I've argued in the past, appropriate monetary policy should be responsive to these kinds of signals. Now, it is worth reiterating, though, a point that I made earlier. Maximum employment for monetary policy is not the same as maximum employment for all policymakers. Congress and the President can choose to provide direct subsidies to employers for hiring. Such subsidies will increase the federal deficit. They do have the power to increase maximum employment for the FOMC. So let me wrap up. The overarching theme of my speech has been monetary policy transparency. And I pointed out the FOMC has made major strides toward greater transparency in recent decades, especially over the past 2 years. These steps mean that we're more accountable to the public and more effective as policymakers. It's especially noteworthy that in our January framework statement, the committee has set a clear quantitative objective for our price stability mandate, 2% inflation per year. I think all Americans can take great pride in these improvements in FOMC communication over the past 15 or so years. But of course, there's still more that can be done. Too often, our communications about the future course of the economy imply considerably more certainty than we can ever possibly have. We should be more transparent about the uncertainties that we face as policymakers. We can and should use scenario analysis to describe our policy and respond to new information about those uncertainties. Along these lines, we can learn from the practices of other central banks. For example, in today's talk, I spent a great deal of time discussing the uncertainties associated with formulating a quantitative measure of maximum employment for the FOMC. An interested Swedish citizen would have been able to read many rich and detailed discussions of exactly this issue in the Swedish Central Bank's monetary policy reports in the mid-1990s. Thanks for listening to my remarks. I'll be happy to take your questions.